Sheldrake on Shakespeare. Hamlet. Rhetoric. As I mentioned in my episode asking how much of Hamlet is original, I have decided to break the habit of a lifetime and do two episodes on this mammoth play. Some will feel that they have already heard quite enough about this play from me and other sources, so I want to do something off the beaten track. I have chosen something unapologetically obscure and difficult. This will be by far the most technically complex episode of the podcast series, but the play demands it. If you are listening to this series at all, then you are not afraid of difficulty, and I promise that I will lead us back to the big ideas of the play in the end. One of the reasons Shakespeare is such a great artist is that when he explores an idea, he explores it at every level of the play. Imagine the structure of any dramatic writing, starting with the whole play at the top, going down through characters, acts and scenes, into speeches, sentences and individual lines, before you get down to the microscopic levels of phrases, words, syllables and sounds. When Shakespeare explores disguise or deceit, the language itself becomes full of puns and riddles. Sentence structure becomes complex and difficult to follow. When he explores love, the language becomes musical and harmonious, and the poetic form echoes the relationship of the lovers. When war, the very scenes seem to be fighting each other, and speeches crash around like cannonballs into ramparts. Content and form collaborate in all art, to some extent, but nobody does it as thoroughly as Shakespeare. How does this apply to Hamlet? It seems to me that much of Hamlet is about things combining and separating, often in ways that the characters or audience find disturbing. I think this unites many of the themes of the play: death and life, the two brothers, the two marriages, the country and the royal court, the warring nations of Norway and Denmark, the medieval and the Renaissance, theatre and reality, you get the idea. Things are diverging and converging in unexpected ways. This is all reasonably obvious at the macro level, but Shakespeare creates the same sense, the same uneasy mixedness, at the level of the phrase. Shakespeare studied classical, Latin and Greek rhetoric at his Stratford Grammar School. Indeed, he studied little else. Rhetoric is a dirty word these days and usually means something between propaganda and lying. Renaissance educators, on the other hand, felt that those who would lead society ought to be able to express themselves in whatever way was required by their topic and audience. So they taught boys, and they were almost entirely boys, how to write and speak. Modern educators have largely dropped this study of rhetoric, meaning that to uncover its presence in older works feels like an archaeological project, but it was second nature to Shakespeare and people of his education, and he would have recognised all the terms I am going to use here. I want to dig around beneath the topsoil of the text and explore two aspects of rhetoric that perform Shakespeare's dramatic work in this play. The first is called Hendiades. Then I want to consider two very similar rhetorical techniques as one package, metonymy and synecdoche. Hendiades, which is just Greek for one through two, is a very simple technique where you join two similar words together using and to express a single idea. They have to be the same part of speech, verb, adjective, noun, etc. And the feature usually has the effect of giving you the combined total of their meanings, whilst also preserving their individual force. When the ghost of Hamlet's father appears to him late in Act 1, he is returning briefly from purgatory. In the Catholic universe, if you are not so bad you need to go to hell, but not quite good enough to go to heaven immediately, you suffer hellfire in purgatory until your sins have been, as the ghost explains, burnt and purged away, after which one can progress to heaven. Burnt and purged away. That is our first Hendiades, and Shakespeare is using it to complicate the situation. By using two verbs, he can put the burning, the physical human pain with which he wants Prince Hamlet and the audience to engage, at the front, whilst also introducing the sense of spiritual cleansing. There is a simplicity and confusion in Hendiades that suits Shakespeare's purpose here. The ghost can only be a spirit come from the dead, but at the same time, we need to engage with him as a human character. Think of the central and as a multiplication symbol in this little grammatical equation, rather than simple addition. The high watermark of this, and where we can zoom out to some big ideas again, is one of the turning points of the play, Act 3, Scene 4, in which Hamlet kills Polonius, a court official and the father of Ophelia, his former lover, and then gives his mother Gertrude a very hard time about how quickly she forgot her first husband, King Hamlet, and moved on to his inferior brother, Claudius. This is the passage of dialogue containing more Hendiades than any other in the play, and that cannot be an accident. It's worth me quoting the dozen or so examples to give you a sense of what's going on. Hamlet wonders if Gertrude's heart is proof and bulwark against sense. All these pairs mean very similar things. Proof and bulwark both mean a barrier, though bulwark is specifically a military defence. He says her supposed incest with Claudius blurs the grace and blush of modesty. He refers to the earth as this solidity and compound mass. Gertrude joins in, "Ay me, what act that roars so loud and thunders in the index? King Hamlet had an eye to threaten and command. He was a combination and a form indeed. How could Gertrude leave old King Hamlet to feed and batten on Claudius? Gertrude sees black and grained spots upon her soul. Hamlet accuses them of honeying and making love. Claudius is a murderer and a villain, a king of shreds and patches. And at this moment of bitterest conflict, the ghost of King Hamlet reappears to direct Prince Hamlet away from Gertrude and back towards Claudius's villainy, as if he has been summoned by this torrent and flood, even I'm doing it now, of Hendiades." Why has Shakespeare's deployment of this gone into overdrive here? Partly it just adds emotional impact to a character's speech if they get to say the important concepts twice. We have the idiom of giving somebody both barrels, as in a shotgun, and perhaps that is the emotional core of Hendiades in a dramatic situation. But for a more sophisticated reading, remember what I said about things combining and separating in this play. The central combination, the one that drives Hamlet wild, is his mother marrying his father's brother and committing, as he sees it, incest. Hendiades precisely mirrors that confusion in the roles. Shakespeare has selected, consciously or unconsciously, the perfect rhetorical figure to get that sense of uneasy union into the very linguistic DNA of the play, giving us a dose of discomfort every time someone uses one. For Shakespeare and his characters, words are never merely the clothes that thoughts wear. So often in Shakespeare, the language is the story. Let us move on to metonymy and synecdoche. They are closely related. Metonymy is a way of referring to something by referring to something closely associated with it. When we wish to refer to the monarchy, for example, we say the crown. That is metonymy. Synecdoche is a specific kind of metonymy. With synecdoche, you make a part of something stand in for the whole of it. So whereas the crown is associated with the monarchy but not actually a physical part of the monarch, if I say that a restaurant bill comes to £20 a head, a part of each person's body, their head, is standing in for the whole of it. There are plenty of lines that demonstrate one or the other, metonymy or synecdoche, in a straightforward sense. The kingdom is contracted in one brow of woe, at King Hamlet's death, for example, or the whole ear of Denmark is rankly abused by lies. But as I reread, I began to spot all kinds of symbolic, I mean bigger than words, symbolic examples of these relationships as well. Most interestingly, perhaps for those of us in the UK, Shakespeare seems to be asking whether the relationship between the monarch and the nation is synecdoche, some profound and unbreakable connection, or metonymy, merely close association. Elizabethans theorised the nation-state as a human body, the body politic. The monarch was the head, and the rest of the people, the body. The queen was in charge and they could not survive without her, but any sickness in any part of the body, including the head, affected the whole body. There are explicit references to this on a few occasions in Hamlet. Laertes explains to his sister Ophelia that Hamlet may not choose his own lover and wife, because his choice must be circumscribed under the voice and yielding of that body whereof he is the head. Rosencrantz, at a badly chosen moment, explains to Claudius that never alone did the king sigh, but with a general groan. The rest of the population sighs when the king sighs. This theory makes the monarch synecdoche for the rest of the nation. He or she is a part standing in for the whole. Shakespeare's question seems to be, well, is that true? I can find no positive reference to that relationship anywhere in this play. Either the relationship between monarch and nation is a limit on the monarch, or it is simply untrue. The murder of an anointed king, followed by the usurpation of the throne by his brother, followed by the murder of him and his queen, followed by the successful invasion of a foreign power, means that in Shakespeare's Denmark, at least, the synecdochic relationship is well and truly shattered, leaving us only with metonymy, a mere close association between monarch and nation, monarch and subject. I think there's more than a hint of political radicalism here. As England approached the brave new world of post-Elizabeth, post-Tudor rule and the prospect of a new king from Scotland, Shakespeare asks at every level of this text whether there is automatically a divine, even meaningful relationship between the ruler and the ruled. I apply this question to our own time as well. After the reign of the second Queen Elizabeth, we are now asking this question again. Elizabeth II seems to have been synecdochic with the nation, which is to say that many people felt that she was somehow a part of the nation, and that a part of the nation therefore died with her when she died. Charles III, however respected or not he may be individually, seems at the moment to be metonymic, closely associated with Britain, of course, but not actually an integral part of it in the way the late Queen was. I suppose there is no reason this could not change over time, but this difference highlights Shakespeare's interest in this play in the nature of royal succession. What is being passed on? A deep spiritual connection with the nation? Or is it merely the trappings of monarchy that are being transferred, and connections have to be forged anew by the individual monarch? This play seems to suggest the latter. So I have tried to explain, if the terms haven't lost all meaning for you, that Hendiades and the twin features of metonymy and synecdoche tell us much about what is going on in this play when they occur in their usual linguistic senses. Beyond that, I have also claimed that the latter two serve as useful metaphorical tools with which to read some of the play's structures of authority. In Shakespeare, the language is the story. In Hamlet, the story of unusual and uneasy combinations and separations, mixings and fracturings, is told at the level of the phrase, by Hendiades, metonymy, and synecdoche. Shakespeare's ease with these figures of rhetoric is such that they work on you without you knowing about them. I hope that now that you do know about them, you can get a little more out of this bottomless play. This has been a Sheldrake on Shakespeare podcast. Thank you for listening. and farewell.